and Commerce Committee will now come to order. It is 3:19 p.m. on February 19th, 2020 in Barnes Room 124. Members present are Representative Gillis, Hannon, Story, Stutes, Field, and myself, Rep. Sponholz. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we get started, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Labor and Commerce Secretary from Records, and Carson Walters from the Juneau. Carson Walters from the Juneau LAO for staffing the committee today. Today we have three bills up. We have House Bill 91 by Representative Jennifer Johnson on naturopaths, Senate Bill 106 by Senator Begich on homeowners and renters insurance, and finally House Bill 113 by Representative Sharon Jackson on military family employment preferences. And first up is House Bill 91. Would Aaron Shine, staff to Rep. Johnson, come forward, put yourself on the record, and give us a brief recap. And I believe before you go into your comments, we're going to have a CS that we're going to introduce.
Madam Chair, I move the Labor and Commerce Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 91, work order number 31-LS0608/K. As a working document.
All right, and I will object for the purposes of discussion. Ms. Shine, would you walk us through the bill and the changes in the CS?
For the record, my name is Erin Shine, and I'm staff to Representative Johnston. She sends her regrets. She's actually in finance right now dealing with the operating budget, so she cannot be here today with us. Thank you for hearing House Bill 91 again. It's my pleasure to be before you again. I have an explanation of changes of kind of the broad issues that are the differences between the previous draft, version M and version K. In section 2, this adds a naturopathy advisory board for purposes of making recommendations for adoption of regulations and other department matters relating to naturopaths. This is an advisory board. It's not a standing board like you would a medical board or another licensing professional board. It is an advisory committee or an advisory board that would be called upon when the department needs their help looking at regulations or other matters related to their profession. And then sections 3 through 7, 10 through 15, and 18, Madam Chair, those are kind of the bulk of what this CS is incorporating. This is giving the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, as well as under the Division of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, appropriate powers and oversight for naturopathic doctors for licensing, for investigations, and for disciplinary sanctions. Last year when we introduced, or when Representative Johnston introduced the bill, it came to light that the division might not have the actual powers that they need to be able to maintain public safety. And so through this process, we thought it would be a nice time to potentially update those statutes, as I outlined in the PowerPoint, that they haven't been really updated since 1986. So that incorporates a lot of the same language that is used for the medical board, other medical professions, or other medical doctors throughout the state to give the same powers and duties for those disciplinary sanctions, licensing, and investigations. In Section 8, this adds a provision that requires that a naturopath that wants to prescribe, as outlined in the CS, which hasn't changed from the previous CS, has to pass the pharmacology portion of the naturopathic physician licensing examination. In Section 8, this amends to increase the public health duties and also the duties to report, similar to other healthcare professionals, such as medical doctors in the state. In Section 14, it adds a requirement for the department to report any action on a naturopathic license in the state to the National Practitioner Data Bank. And then Section 15 adds title protections for naturopaths. And Section 22 updates the effective date to January 1st, 2021. Madam Chair, I'm happy to walk through a sectional analysis as we go, if you would prefer, but that's the bulk of the changes that have been incorporated into the CS for your consideration.
Are there any questions about the CS? Ooh, that's warm. At ease. Back on the record, Representative Story has a question.
Yes, thank you. my question has to do with, it seems that this new committee substitute narrows the scope even farther for, if you're a naturopath, what you could prescribe for medication.
Through the chair, Representative Story, I do not believe so. What we envisioned was the same sort of prohibitions in this CS as it was in the previous CS, which would prohibit them from prescribing controlled substances or chemotherapeutic agents.
Okay. Follow-up. Uh-huh. I just meant it seems like, if I remember last time, they did not have to pass that one part of that the class, so it narrows it even farther. So to me, it narrows it.
Through the chair, Representative Story, their prescriptive abilities would remain the same. However, for them to be able to prescribe in the state, they would have to successfully pass that elective portion of the pharmacology portion of the exam, the national exam that naturopaths take for licensing.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? All right, Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I noticed that the fiscal note is a zero fiscal note. And I'm curious, when there has to be a board that oversees them, how there can be a zero fiscal note.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, the previous version, I believe, had $4,200 appropriated for adopting regulations. That was for the previous version. If this version K, were to move from the committee, it would probably get a new fiscal note where the department or the division director would probably update that to reflect the costs. I would say that any of the licensing professions bear their own costs and their licensing fees, so this wouldn't be general fund spend. This would be receipts from the licensing that would be paying for the cost of whatever it would be to whenever they'd be called together for an advisory capacity.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. With the changes that were explained by Ms. Shen, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS as a working document? All right. Seeing none, the CS has been adopted. And we have a few people here today for invited testimony. I think Sarah Chambers is here. Are you here just for questions, Ms. Chambers? All right. And then we have Suzette Mayu. Am I pronouncing that correctly? All right, Dr. Suzette Mayu, who is with the board. I'm sorry, with the organization. Could you remind me?
Madam Chair, she's a licensed naturopathic doctor in Fairbanks.
The Alaska Association of Naturopathic Physicians is
yes.
Where she was. All right. All right. We'll proceed forward to Dr. Mayu's testimony then. Yeah, you can have a seat. Dr. Mayu, are you on the line?
I am. Hi. So thank you for hearing the bill today and for hearing my testimony. Do I need to announce myself officially first?
You do need to officially introduce yourself. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. So I am Dr. Suzette Mayu, and I am calling on behalf of the Alaska Association of Naturopathic Physicians, of which I am the secretary. And I have a practice up in Fairbanks.
And my apologies for butchering your name, dear Dr. Mayu.
You came pretty close. Yeah, you did well. So, as I said, my practice is up in Fairbanks. I completed my undergraduate degree at UAF and then moved down to Oregon for my doctoral degree. And it was definitely a difficult decision in moving back to Alaska after completing 8 years of schooling, knowing that I would have such a limited scope of practice. And as the secretary of the AKANP, I hear this again and again from students that are nearing graduation and considering moving to Alaska. We're missing out on a lot of qualified, capable doctors that don't want to accept our limited scope up here. We are trained as primary care physicians, and it's a waste of our training to have such a limited scope. I also personally know several NDs that have left the Fairbanks area to practice in different states for that same reason. I've been practicing in Fairbanks since 2011 in several different clinics and capacities. For most of that time, I worked in natural alternative health clinics. And since 2012, I've also worked within an intensive outpatient treatment program for addiction alongside mostly licensed professional counselors. And starting this past year, I'm working in an integrative clinic that's owned by a medical doctor internist. So I work alongside him, along with a physician's assistant, nurse practitioner, and several massage therapists. So I get to work alongside my colleagues on the other side of the aisle here. Personally, in my practice, the inability to prescribe has forced my patients to see other providers, wasting their time and money. Like, I often see women for their annual exams, then they'll need to double up and see someone else to have their birth control prescribed. Or I'll see people for acute illness, and if I find they need antibiotics, I need to refer to urgent care. Patients often still prefer to see me because of the time I spend with them and the other treatments and options I can provide. But, you know, the reality of medicine is that prescriptions and minor office procedures are often necessary. My hands are tied in the state right now. As you heard from Aaron last week and saw in the packet, we have a great record of safety both in Alaska and in states that allow for a full scope of practice. We are fully trained as physicians, and we want to be staying in Alaska providing safe and effective care that's much needed here. And I do want to add that if you are to hear testimony in opposition, I really encourage you to keep in mind that the claims that may have been made accusing us of malpractice have been unsubstantiated. They were never reported to the state, and they should have been, so they could have been fully investigated. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Dr. Mio? All right, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering, and I'm sorry I can't find it right now in my packet, if you have had the specific classes in pharmacology so you would be able to prescribe.
Yes, for sure. Thank you for asking that. So when I graduated in 2011, I believe I was the last year where we had specific separate courses in pharmacology, so most medical schools have now switched over to all systems-based training, so we learn about the medications along with gastroenterology and respiratory concerns, cardiac concerns, but we are fully covering pharmacology in those different systems. And I, again, did my training down in Oregon, and if I'd stayed and pursued licensure there, I would be, have the full scope of practice of a primary care physician. We definitely have the training, and the addition to the bill that was read today to require that testing in pharmacology, that would ensure that our current knowledge and training is up to date.
No. All right. Representative Stutes?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you have any residency involved in your education.
So it is not required. As a naturopathic doctor, so the only state that requires a residency is Utah currently. So in Alaska, we have not required it. I completed a year-long clinical residency, and I will say many of us in the state have, but it's optional. There are not enough residency positions for naturopathic doctors in the U.S., and we don't practice hospital-based medicine. So similar to nurse practitioners or physician's assistants, we do like internship-style training as part of our degree. So we do have clinical training, but we don't do that hospital-based residency.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. I guess I've had a little problem understanding as we've examined this bill what surgeries naturopaths would likely do in the event this passed or could do. So could you just explain, I guess it's section 8, number 3, perform procedures in the office using operative, electrical, or other methods, including the use of antiseptics and local anesthetics for the surgical repair and care of superficial lacerations, and then it goes down the list of a few other procedures. So what surgeries would you envision doing if this bill were to pass?
Yeah, so small biopsies, mole removals to be able to send those off to pathology, stitches of minor cuts, and then a big part of that for many of us would also include IUD placement and removal in the office. But it's all confined to the epidermis and just using like local anesthesia. Does that thoroughly enough answer the question?
Follow?
Sure. Does how does dermatological training differ in a naturopath program versus the training an MD would do? Say, for example,
for
removing moles.
Diagnosis mostly?
Yeah.
I would say it is pretty darn similar. So for those, where our training differs more is in the variety of treatments offered and the philosophy of medicine. So when it comes to the basic sciences or pathology or, you know, assessing for illness, that is on par. So we believe the same things there.
Thank you.
Do you have a question? All right. Are there any other questions for Dr. Mew while we have her? All right. Looks like we have no further questions for you at this time. Dr. Mew, thank you very much for making yourself available. At this time, we're going to go ahead and set aside this bill for further consideration by the committee. Thank you very much, Ms. Schein.
Thank you.
All right. And next up, we have Senate Bill 106 with Senator Begich and Ms. Lukey Gale Tobin. Please come forward and give us a brief recap on the legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Begich. I'm the State Senator for District J, which is downtown Anchorage, and with me is my legislative assistant, Lukey Gale Tobin. And the bill that we're, of course, dealing with is SB 106, which relates to insurance coverage for homeowners and renters, and relates to a very specific issue, and you'll hear testimony on that today. Very specifically, it basically eliminates a loophole, if you will, that causes the loss of insurance if somebody makes a claim against a criminal action that might have occurred in their home. So if somebody has stolen goods and then you make a claim on those goods, the insurance company now has the opportunity to simply not renew your insurance. What this bill would do would be to give you a period of grace where you could make a claim within a three-year time period and not be penalized for having made that claim. So in other words, it's a bill to keep a victim from being re-victimized. As I mentioned last time we were here, we worked with the insurance industry as well as a particular consumer who identified this issue who you'll hear from today. And we believe that we've come up with the answer to it, which did pass the Senate unanimously. Representative Hannon had two questions, Madam Chair, that we provided some additional information for. The first is the number of states that may have similar kinds of legislation. There are at least 10 that have on their books, and we've provided that to staff, and I believe that's been circulated out to others. So there's each of them differ in various capacities. The bill that we have before us is one that we think meets Alaska's needs. Secondarily, there was a question about whether personal insurance covered homeowners insurance and renters insurance, and it does. If I've actually taken the liberty of borrowing your books here, your statute books, and under section 2136-460, the paper handed out says 450, but it's actually 460. Section I. It under subsection 7, personal insurance means, B, homeowners coverage, including mobile homeowners, manufactured homeowners, condominiums owners, and renters coverage, and C, dwelling property coverage. Those are explicitly referred to in the bill, and that is that answers that second question that Representative Hannon had. So once again, the number of states as well as the coverage of both personal and homeowners insurance, as well as dwellings, which I hadn't realized was covered under the bill. So I'm an author that should have known better. Anyway, with that, if there aren't any further questions, I know that we have somebody online, I think, mm-hmm. who's willing to testify about their own personal experience.
We live and learn every day, don't we?
We do.
All right, are there any questions for the senator? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and open this up to public testimony at this point in time. And I believe that we have one person on the line, Penny Gage, who wishes to testify. Ms. Gage, are you on the line? You might have us on mute.
All right. I guess not. Is there anybody in the room that'd like to testify? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on this. All right. Are there, I don't think that we've received any amendments on this bill. So are there any other questions or discussion by the committee before we consider a formal motion? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. I guess, you know, using my spidey senses and sensing that the expert on all things insurance with regard to Alaska is in our room, I'm wondering if we should just ask her if there's anything we don't know, haven't talked about, questions or unforeseen circumstances that we need to address.
Ms. Wingheyer, would you like to come up to the stand?
For the record, my name is Lori Wingheyer. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, this has been an issue, particularly in the Anchorage and Mat-Su area, where people are losing their insurance. It's not tons of people, but there have been where the insurance company has canceled after having a claim. We do not see a problem with the bill. We have worked with the insurers and with the sponsor. It has gone through a number of hearings, and we think it strengthens consumer protections in the event they're victimized by a crime.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Wingheyer. Those are the magic words I wanted to hear on the record.
All right. All right. You have a question? Representative Rasmussen?
I have more of a comment, and I just wanted to thank the bill sponsor for bringing this piece of legislation forward, and I will happily support moving it out of committee and happy to support it on the floor. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. If there are no other questions or comments, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 106, Work Order 31LS0476/U from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right. Seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 106 passes from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the committee report.
Thank you.
All right, now we are back on the record, everybody. We are now going to move to House Bill 113 by Representative Jackson. Can you go ahead and put yourself on the record, introduce your bill for us? Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Representative Sharon Jackson with House District 13. Before you is House Bill 113, a bill that I refer to as Blue Star, Gold Star Families Act. The purpose for House Bill 113 is to extend existing hiring preferences for veterans and members of the National Guard to include Blue Star families, which are spouses and dependents of active duty service members, and Gold Star families, which are spouses and dependents of service members that died while serving. Data from the Department of Defense shows that military spouses are amongst the highest underemployed nationally. Madam Chair, Alaska is the home of thousands of veteran members of the National Guard and military families. Spouses make up about 2% of the state's population. Military spouses and their families sacrifice almost as much as the service member. From unintended biases to not being able to get interviews due to gaps in their resumes. Mm-hmm. Research indicate that 40% of military spouses have college education and the majority work in professionals covering areas such as healthcare, dental, education, and child care. Through HB 113, Alaska will join 24 other states to extend hiring preference benefits to military families. This is an opportunity for our state to have a larger pool of professionals for in areas where we are having trouble filling the gaps. This is a way to empower our economy and another way of honoring them for their service. My staff, Elijah Verhagen, is here to go over the summary of changes and the sectional analysis. We are very happy to answer any questions you may have. Again, thank you, Madam Chair and the committee.
For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Jackson. I'm also going to go over this PowerPoint that you all have in your packets. Would you, Madam Chair, like me to go over the sectional first and then this?
You can do the presentation and then the sectional. First. Yeah.
Okay. So House Bill 113, as was just mentioned, there's Blue Star and Gold Star families, and here's the definitions for both of them up there. The what of this bill is extending current state hiring preferences to military spouses and dependents for spouses married to active duty members of the military, as well as those in the National Guard, and as well as spouses of those whose spouses was killed in the line of duty or in action. And it also includes, it's not shall language, but the private sector may also, if they have two qualified individuals, they can choose to use this a military hiring preference in the private sector as well.
Do you have a question, Representative Hannon?
So, through the chair, on that slide it says, the second sentence is, extend liability protections to the private sector. Can you tell me what that means in that context?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hannon, on page 2 of the bill, it says, starting on line 12, active military veteran and family hiring preferences allowed. When hiring an employee, a private employer may grant an employee preference to a person in active service. It goes through this list. And then also, if you look down on line 23, we're adding 2 and 3, the spouse or dependent child of a person described in 1 of this section, so married to someone there or dependent of someone described in 1, as well as bullet 3, the surviving spouse or dependent child of a person who, at the time of death, was a person in active service or on furlough from active service as described in 1 of this section. And then it has these definitions. So this is legally putting in statute that in the private sector an employer may hire a military spouse solely because they are a military spouse, whereas currently that is not in statute. Did that answer your question?
Does that answer your question, Representative Hannon?
Not quite.
It says extend liability protections, and I think that's the question. Yeah. Is it liability from lawsuit for unlawful preferences?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon and committee members, yes. It currently, if someone were to choose, because it's not in statute, to hire a military spouse instead of someone else who's equally qualified, I believe that they would be able to be sued. And this is giving them they're free from that liability because now it's written in statute that they may give a hiring preference to a military spouse.
Follow?
So I thought that, I mean, a private sector business employer can hire who they want. We heard this bill once last year, and for instance, in this community, we have a very large Coast Guard family population. And it's a common sort of perception that Coast Guard kids are easy, good hires, because if they don't show up to work on time, one call home and that problem's done. They show up to work on time. And so Coast Guard kids are frequently the first round of hires for seasonal businesses because of their dependability and accountability to a military structure. And I guess I had never perceived that there was any legal grounds to say, you as a private sector employer, you want to hire all Coast Guard kids, that's fine. That's within your prerogative to do. And so the word liability from that has thrown me.
Through the chair, that makes a lot of sense, but that language is not in the bill. Excuse me. We are just making it private business are private. We're not here to tell them what they can or can't do, but this will be extended to them to at least give a military spouse the interview.
So perhaps the language in the presentation is a little bit confusing, and we will also have the opportunity to hear from the Department of Labor a little bit later, and so there might be an opportunity to have a discussion about what liability could potentially be incurred right now if there were such liability.
That's a good question.
Representative Fields.
I feel like we heard this bill last year from Chris Tuck. It's the same bill?
No,
it's a separate bill. I think that was House Bill 93.
Madam Chair, he heard this bill from us, from myself. We did present it to this committee last year.
Follow-up?
And there are four new members, just clarification, before we get to the follow-up, there are four new members of this committee this year, and so there is a couple of members who've been around. You might have heard this. There was also a military spouse bill that Representative Chris Tuck did have last year, and so that was my confusion. Representative Fields.
So, as I recall, Chris Tuck's bill was about granting private employers the ability to kind of hire veteran first because they're a veteran. Mm-hmm. So the only difference between this bill and that one is his was for veterans. This is for
military spouses
and their family members. Is that an accurate understanding of it? Or
I can't say that I understand, because being a veteran myself, we already have preference points. So I'm not clear. I thought he had one for licensing. Not sure.
It was for licensure of military spouses. We heard it in Military and Veterans Affairs as well. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
My memory. Yeah.
So similar, related, but not the same bill. All right. Moving along, Representative Jackson and Mr. Verhagen.
Thank you. So why is this necessary in our opinion? Military spouses are among the highest unemployed, and again, there's information in all your guys' packets. Surveys showing these numbers, they're the highest among the highest unemployed and underemployed group in the United States. And despite their education, also in your packets, as was mentioned by Representative Jackson, 40% of in 2017, according to this poll that was done with over 4,000 military spouses, they came to the percentage of 40% of military spouses have a college degree, and upwards of over 60% have some college experience. When compared to spouses in the civilian sector, it's around 29%. So we have this wealth of information and knowledgeable candidates for jobs in our communities, and unfortunately, because of reasons mentioned previously and also in your packets, them only being in an area sometimes for only 3 years, they're not even extended an opportunity to interview, even though they're definitely qualified. And then also in the packets, you'll find that 9 out of 10 of these military spouses are women. And so we know that a happy spouse makes the military personnel happy as well. And so we're doing our best to help show honor to both of them, the spouse and the military members serving. So under unemployment, the number of unemployed military spouses averages at more than 40%. There, again, is several polls in your guys' research packets that, that talks about that those percentages. And underemployment, a lot of these people, due to issues that Representative Tuck's bill brings up as well, licensing issues, et cetera, a lot of these individuals are very overqualified for the jobs that they can get because their licenses have not transferred into Alaska yet. And so, again, this bill is aimed to in the private sector and in the state to give them a hiring preference.
Representative Rasmussen has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get clarification. You mentioned previously that 29% of civilian spouses have a degree, or are you saying that they have a degree and they're currently unemployed? I was just trying to get clarification on that.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, 29.9%, I think is what the number is, has a college degree. And so it's not saying that they're not employed. It's just they have a college degree, while 40% of spouses of the military personnel have a college degree. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Where did you get that data?
So if you turn to, which is provided in your packet, it's entitled Military Spouses in the Labor Market, Council of Economic Advisors, May 2018. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is the second page. It's blue, like this. It's in your packets. The second page there, there's a graph, and it shows military spouses with a college degree and some college, and then compared to civilian non-institutionalized population. Do you see that?
I have a question about that, actually. It's a little bit unclear to me in this particular statistic. I understand when you're talking about military spouses, you've got the military personnel, and you compare then who is the military spouse, and you say that 40% of those spouses are have a degree. But in the mainstream population, it's 29.7%. But compared to who, are we counting me, or are we counting my husband as the spouse, and who is the primary? It's a little bit unclear to me. It's an uncomfortable statistic.
So, Representative Spanholz. On page one of that information, mm-hmm. it says the second paragraph up from the bottom, mm-hmm. Right next to footnote one, it says, according to the ACS survey, working age military spouses are predominantly female, 92%, and they are young. Although the average American adult is working age is 41 years old, working age military spouses are 33 years old on average. And then it continues there. It says military spouses are also more educated than other civilian non-institutionalized Americans of working age, suggesting that losing their contributions to the labor market is particularly detrimental to the American economy. While approximately 30% of the U.S. working age population has a college degree, approximately 40% of military spouses in this age range do.
So we're just clarifying, this is the civilian non-institutionalized population in the United States of workers.
Yes.
Okay. We're not talking about spouses.
No.
Yeah.
All right.
Does that make sense now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're all caught up now. Yeah.
All right. Good questions. And so, as well, so 24 states have already instituted some sort of a hiring preference for spouses of military. And so with this bill, we are looking to join those states extending. And we, as we all know, Alaska has a very high percentage of military. And so we want to show them that we are respecting and honoring and hopefully giving a preference to the military spouses in the state. And with that, I can take more questions, or I can go into the sectional, whatever.
Why don't you proceed forward with the sectional?
So section one, this section does not prohibit a private employer from having hiring preferences for persons described in section two of this bill. As we had talked about before, it doesn't say they shall, because we don't want to be doing that, but it says that they may. Section 2, this section repeals and reenacts and cleans up the language, is what the legal lawyers like to say, the current statute by adding definitions removed from section 1 for clarity. This section does not prohibit a private employer from having hiring preferences to active military veterans and families. This section adds language to include spouses and dependent children of deceased service members to the list. Section 3 is conformatory language. The section amends the State Personnel Act to reference definition as stated in Section 4 for consistency. Section 4 is the bulk of the bill. This section amends the employment preference for veterans or former prisoners of war by adding new language to include families of an active duty service member, veteran, or former prisoner of war. This section clarifies the type of preference given the hiring process and whether the applicant is disabled or not. Subsection B was removed for consistency. Section 5 clarifies that a person may receive an employment preference under only one of the categories described in 3 and 4. A person may use a preference without limitation when being considered for a position for which persons who are not currently state employees are being considered. If the recruitment for a position is limited to state employees, preference under A or C of this section may not be counted. Section 5 also adds language to include spouses or dependent children for consistency with other sections. Section 6, we did not want to change collective bargaining agreements, so Section 6 clarifies and was added in the CS from Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. This section clarifies that this bill does not involve interpreting amendments of a collective bargaining agreement and makes a reference to that subsection. And Section 7 defines a dependent child, and 8 removes language that has been included in Section 4 of this bill.
All right. Are there any questions? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And I believe I asked this question last year. And it comes to the link that the preference is given in the case of the death of the veteran or the service member, so a Blue Star family. Is there a time limit that your spouse and dependent child at the time of your death, hiring preference expires?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, as long as the dependent is in school, 19, or in college up to the age 23, they are covered under this benefit. Once they are grown and on their own, they're, you know. So the limit is 19 years of age or 23 if they're attending college.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
And that's for the children.
Yeah.
So what about for the spouse?
The spouse is covered until she remarries. If she remarries, she no longer receives the benefits of her deceased spouse.
Or he.
Or he. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But it could install a lifetime benefit.
It could be 50 possibly.
Years.
It could for the working years of an adult. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good question?
Yes. Thank you for bringing this forward. I am wondering if we have any information from the other 24 states about how this has been working, how it's helped employment in those areas. Any things to note about how the program's been going?
That's a good question, and we may have someone online to answer that. But for the state of Alaska, I'm looking forward to it for several reasons. You know, we have a lot of what we say building our economy, and it would be nice to build this bridge to allow the military families to feel a part of our community. Alaska, many don't realize, is considered an overseas tour. Alaska is a hardship tour. And the spouses are pretty isolated within the world of the military. We have positions out here that we need to fill, and I look forward to us building this bridge and getting people into the positions. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Is there someone online, Madam Chair?
We have representatives of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and we also have people with the Department of Labor in Labor Standards and Safety. And then we have Megan James with the Alaska Coalition for Veterans and Military Families. Those are our sort of three folks for testimony.
Madam Chair, Verdi Bowen may have information, but if you don't mind, I would like to give this committee heads up that this summer I attended several legislative conferences, and they are aware of this bill, and any day there will be a op-ed in Washington Times sharing to, you know, the rest of the country that Alaska is looking at this seriously. Okay. Mr. Right. Bowen?
Did you have a follow-up? Representative Story?
I wasn't sure if we had someone online who could answer that question. It'd be interesting to note.
Mr. Bowen?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Verdi Bowen, the Director of Veterans Affairs. Could you restate member restate the question, please?
Sure. On our packet, we have a list of 24 other states who are providing veterans preferences to spouses or surviving spouses. And I was wondering if we had any information on how this was, how it was helping the other states or any unique situations that have come up through this bill.
The chair to, is this Representative Hannah?
Representative Story.
Representative Story, I'm sorry. Maryland currently has this bill. They're the only ones that I have actually tracked. And what they reflected in Maryland was that the spouses and children were able to be employed much faster than prior to the activation of the bill, simply because of the fact that spouses and children were actually receiving employment within the first year of the military member being in the state, vice the second and third year as they go through and work through the wickets of finding employment.
Do you have another question? No.
Thank you.
Mr. Bowen, I have a question. Are there any other states that have limited the length of the benefit for widows? It does seem widows or widowers, it seems like part of the hardship and the challenges that widowers or widows may experience may have sort of a limitation based on their spouse has passed on and they're no longer sort of following their spouse through various stations, that they may then not face the same obstacles. So are there other states that have sort of sunsetted the preference after 10 years or 15 years, for example?
No, Madam Chair. Most of the states do not sunset the Gold Star Clause. Under the Gold Star Clause, when a family member is killed in action or dies of wounds in action, what they do is that they fall back to what the VA does, and the VA provides DIC payments until the family member remarries. And most states use that as their reference point. If the family member remarries, then they lose that. Even in Alaska, we have for our Gold Star plate, if the family member remarries, then they lose access to that Gold Star plate. I'm sorry, the spouse.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Bowen, did you have additional testimony that you wanted to provide while we've got you?
Yes, ma'am. I really would like to see this bill pass simply because of the fact it does a couple of things for our family members. We have quite a few in the state. I don't know if they've brought those numbers forward, but we have probably just over 43,000 active duty National Guard Reserve component family members within the state. That are supporting their 22,000 active duty members. And that has to include guard and reserve components as well. We have quite a few in the state that are here that come in, and usually they come to Alaska on a 3 or a 4 year tour. And there's a lot of stress brought to the family units as they come into the state due to limited resources and funds. A lot of times, many family members do not receive their automobiles right away. It takes a while to get here. They also have household goods that might not or might show up. And then they have the expense of setting up a new house. And usually if there's a job right away that the spouse can walk into or have the ability to attain, then it will lessen that load. The other aspect that I was looking at as I looked at the numbers that we have here is that the number one way that we can reduce stress is to help them gain access to gainful employment, which will help us reduce other factors that could happen within that housing unit. You know, you could have suicide or what, you know, whatever comes along with being in a place that's normally not their home. And I wish my wife was on the phone because generally I would PCS somewhere else and then she would follow me. And so a lot of those factors fell on her. And there was always a lot of stresses of trying to find another a position for her once she got there. And many times it would be close to the end of the assignment time before we moved again, before she was able to get gainful employment or receive gainful employment. Mm-hmm. So it's a real win-win for the state. And then if you add the gold stars in here on top of that, that's even more stressful when you lose that loved one, simply because of the fact that now you're the sole winner of the family, and those benefits that are provided to you by the VA and through the federal government over a period of time, even though the life insurance is around $400,000, it doesn't take long for those funds to fall and disappear, and then they fall back onto the dependent indemnity compensation payments that the VA and the federal government pays. With that, if there's any questions, I'll be on the phone until...
Are there any other questions for Mr. Bowen? All right, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is not directly tied to the bill, but we've been using the term, and we all know it, Gold Star families whose active duty military person dies while in active duty, and then you brought up and mentioned one of the ugly statistics, which is the very high rate of active duty suicide, and I wanted to know whether families whose members die by suicide are still considered Gold Star families.
Through the chair, to Representative Story, it depends on it. The Gold Star usually dictates or is actually provided to people that die in a combat zone, and so if I would have to say that if they took their life in a combat zone or was injured in a combat zone, then that Gold Star identification would be provided to them as well.
Follow-up. Through the chair, and do you know, is there any limit on the life insurance policy that is paid to a family, a surviving spouse and dependent children, if the death is caused by suicide?
Through the chair, to Representative Story, no. The exact amount of the life insurance is paid to the family, irregardless of suicide or not.
Thank you.
All right. That was Representative Hannon, just for the record. Are there any other questions for Mr. Bowden? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. All right.
Madam Chair, may I
Representative
add one thing?
Jackson?
Because it is important in other boards and committees that I sit on. Military families, so I'm a veteran as well as a wife, a spouse. Mm-hmm. And we make decisions that are not normally made. So if my husband was to leave on orders, but I'm working, I'm happy with the job I have, we have conversations for him to take a tour for a year and return while I continue to work. Mm-hmm. So for me not to bring up the fact that military would return back to Alaska if their spouses are working in their professions happily. Yeah, that I think that does make a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, and we also have we have, it looks like, Joe Dunham and Joseph Knowles with the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. Are they just on for questions? Do they have testimony? Just for questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Sponholsa. Deputy Director Joseph Knowles here with Labor Standards and Safety, as well as Joe Dunham, and that's exactly why we're here today, is for questions.
All right. Are there any other questions? Are there any questions for the Labor Standards and Safety Division staff? All right. Looks like you're off the hook, gentlemen. And next up, we have for testimony Megan James with the Alaska Coalition for Veterans and Military Families.
Hi. Thank you for having me today. I just wanted to share some our feedback from our veterans and military families that we work with through the Alaska Coalition for Veterans and Military Families. Many of our military spouses, and to an extent our dependent children, do come to us for assistance in looking for professions. And we work longest with our military spouses because they do have extremely varied working backgrounds, because they have continued to sacrifice their own career for that of their service member as they move from duty location to duty location. Because they have these varied work histories and gaps in employment, on paper they don't look like the greatest hires to some of our employers. So allowing for military spouse preferences would, in essence, even the playing field for our spouses and our Gold Star families and our dependent children as they go from one location to another. Further, if our military families are gainfully employed and spouses are happily working at the duty location where they're at, our service members are going to be mission ready for anything. They're more likely to re-enlist, and their home is likelier to be a more resilient and thriving home because they are not worried about the financial implications of having a military spouse not working while they're gone. And this touches my family in a very personal way. As a military child, we moved 16 times when I was a kid between the ages of birth and 18 years, and we settled in Alaska because of my mom's chosen profession. She was able to continue working in Alaska because of her profession. So when we were moving around from place to place, she wasn't able to get a job, and there were several duty locations where she would be unemployed for the entire 3 years because employers are less likely to hire spouses unless there's a preference, or even if they can get a chance to chat with the employer face-to-face. And by having preferences and resumes available and in front of employers at the outset, knowing that they're a military spouse, is more likely to get them that interview and get them hired. This is by no means a promise of a job. This is just allowing them to have a better chance against other qualified candidates as they are going through the employment process.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. James? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. James. And thank you very much to you, Representative Jackson and Mr. Verhagen, for bringing this before the committee. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for today. We're going to consider this legislation on Friday and look to the will of the committee. If there are any amendments to this bill, please get those to our committee aide, Ted Madsen, by the close of business tomorrow, so 5 p.m. tomorrow. Thank you very much, Representative Jackson.
Thank you very much, everyone.
So on Thursday, we're going to have a joint hearing with the House Health and Social Services Committee at 3 p.m. in Davis Room 106. The subject will be the Alaska Healthcare Transformation Project and the associated legislation, House Bill 229. On Friday, we're going to hear three bills in Labor and Commerce. We're going to take up House Bill 113, again, considering amendments, looking to the will of the committee. For House Bill 229, we're going to follow up on the joint hearing from Thursday
We'll hear from some invited testifiers and go through the legislation in greater detail on Friday. And then on Friday, we'll also hear House Bill 235 by Representative Adam Wohl, which is dealing with the allocations of funding for the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, also known as the TVEP Reauthorization Bill. This will be the first hearing on the bill. We'll be hearing from the bill sponsor and taking invited testimony. The time is 4:24. That's the second time I've done that. I did that last week too, or earlier this week too. 4:24, and this hearing of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is now adjourned. So the